Love Talk Radio.
Ah, that British bitch, she gets me every fucking time. This is V-Spot. I'm Dr. Vic Tater, joined by my associate Bill Foster. And today we're having a special guest, and Matt D. Matt, how are you doing?
Good. It's good to talk to you guys.
Yeah, now, for people unfamiliar with this, and I'm guessing if you're listening to the show, you've probably been to the blogs, so you probably remember the Demolition Project we did. And if you've been to the Death Valley Driver Board, and you're unfortunate enough to do that, you probably know Matt as being the straight man in our relationship.
You're the number 9 poster. I'm the number 10 poster.
Yeah. He's the guy that, if there was a movie and there's the good cop trying to keep the bad cop from beating someone to death, that would be Matt.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Most of the time you end up beating everyone. It's like mutually assured destruction.
Enough chatter. When do we get the guns?
So, Matt, I guess what we're going to get started with is we'll talk about some wrestling. You've been working on you were going through the AWA project, and I don't know, but apparently you're writing on it. It seems like it's got some good reviews from other people.
Yeah, you know, I do this kind of thing, and looking back at it, it's a lot like the way I used to write history papers, where I just write down every fact imaginable, and at the end it kind of forms a picture. So, I think I was also one of the first ones in. Me and Dylan Waco were number 1 and 2 kind of posting on these posts. So we stood out a bit, kind of defined the conversation. But no, it was an enjoyable project. AWA is thought of as this old kind of rickety promotion, and during the 80s they had a lot of good matches.
It's interesting when you're watching AWA, because I've watched some of the 1990s stuff, because I like watching Texas Hangman.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw some matches with Larry Sabisco when he took on Nikita Koloff at Harley Race. They were good matches. And my only thing is that my guess is, because when I read the magazines, is that I think people wanted the AWA to be more than it was.
Well, I think with the magazines, it benefits them to have as many good, big promotions, meaningful promotions at once, because then there's more interest. That's something we saw with the Monday Night Wars. And I think in some ways why they hang on to TNA so much is because competition's good for them.
Right, and it needs more interest, especially if it's companies that aren't necessarily seen by a wider eye. Like, I think Smoky Mountain and ECW helped them because they were kind of their only source for most of the country, so that's why they would get a lot of, I don't want to say, what's the word I was thinking of? I can't think of the word, but basically it was more coverage than you'd think for a small company, but I think that helped for a lot of fans that were buying magazines regularly.
Yeah, and I think even before that, things like Bruiser Brody, you know, a guy that was, you really could learn about him depending on what part of the country you're in, only from the PWIs, and they built up kind of a mythos for him, and that helped them, and it helped him, too.
Yeah, definitely, you know, that's the thing about, because I don't know, because I had this conversation with Dylan Waco, and I don't necessarily think Brody's great, but I think he's better than he gets credit for being at this point.
You know, there's a couple of different lines of argument, and it's only in our small community where he's shat upon at all. Most places still look at him legendarily, even the wrestlers. I think in part it's because he helped a lot of young guys, and it's also because he lived the kind of gimmick that they all wanted to. He went in, he was able to name his price, he was able to name his terms, and, you know, people admire that from inside the industry. Now, outside, I think that it's because a lot of people haven't actually seen the matches. Now, some people say that because the crowds are going nuts, it's all that matters. Obviously, he was doing his job. But if you see some of those matches, a lot of them are rough.
Yeah, I haven't seen a ton of his matches. I've seen some of the old Japan stuff he's done. That's the main things I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he had a
Yeah, and
good
I think in Japan,
with,
you almost have to turn it up.
Yeah.
I think some of the Japan showings are better. With the state stuff, a lot of the things that he was known for, you know, being really fearsome and intense and whatever else, you just don't see. Now, some things you do see, like Flair went on about how he could go an hour, and so he has good cardio, and apparently that's the case. And some people value that more than others, but you know, for the intensity and the strength of the strikes and things like that. On the set, there are definitely a few. There are a couple of Crusher Blackwell matches, and they're going to be in my bottom 15, bottom 20 out of the 150. They're just not good.
Yeah, now I think I believe I saw a match with him when Young Vader that was good. Because Vader went on about that, because Vader said that that wrestling Brody and Hanson for 6 months, he said the first time he got to the ring with a guy that wasn't them, they thought he was crazy. So they said
I'm just saying we don't have, I think, the Brody match on set. We do have Hanson Leon White matches on there, and the Hanson Leon White match is great. You'd love it.
Yeah, I probably have seen it because it's probably something that I sought out at some point. Now, were there some things at AWA, were there any people that were disappointing compared to their reputation?
I was disappointed in the Masked Superstar, if only because he wasn't there for longer and he didn't have longer televised matches. So that was a little bit frustrating. I want to see more out of Colonel DeBeers, and I've seen a lot of Ed Wiskowski from 79-80 from Portland, because I've been doing a lot of watching of that recently, and that stuff ages really well, and he's a great character. In the mid-80s, he was saddled with Snuka when Snuka was a little past his prime, which didn't help. There's one match with Bockwinkel that I really like, but other people aren't going to be as high on, because it's story-driven but not that exciting. So I want to see more out of DeBeers because he's a guy who you really associate with late AWA, and you just don't really see it in the set.
Well, DeBeers, he got a lot of play in the magazines just for the gimmick. How much of the gimmick did you actually get to see?
On the set itself, I watched a lot of TV around it, and his feud with Snuka especially, he went deep into the racial stuff, as you can imagine. But past that, not too much. There's actually this great post-match beating he does on Snuka, which was replayed over and over again in AWA, but that's kind of beside the point.
Well, I find that sometimes with the racial gimmicks or, you know, the racist gimmicks, there are some gimmicks where a guy gets beat up and you don't mind him coming back next week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, whatever, you know, you just want to do it again. But sometimes you'll have a gimmick that's so despicable that when he gets his ass kicked and Doug beat up, you know, you want it to be over.
Yeah, and I think that might have been the case with the Snuka angle because he did such a good job of taking him out. It was really heated stuff, actually. But in general, you know, coming out week after week and saying the same stuff, especially because you're dealing with this Minnesota-type crowd, and I know that they were doing more TV from Vegas at that point, but I don't have great things to say about the AWA crowds. They're kind of typical in some ways, and they, you know, I think in 80 to 83 and 80 to 84, you know that Vern is very conservative in his booking styles and whatnot. I think one thing they were really afraid to do at that point was to put heat on anyone. I don't know if they were afraid of riots or they just thought that people only wanted to see the good guys win and the bad guys lose, even if it was a dusty finish or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, they're really afraid to put heat on the heels.
Now, I haven't actually seen this stuff yet because I'm hoping to eventually, but do you think that when Hogan left the way he did, do you think that changed the way Vern was doing booking?
You know, 84 after Hogan leaves is kind of a weird year. I think that's the year where Otto Wanz gets the belt because he buys it, basically. And then later on, they put it on Martel. And, you know, I don't think so. I really don't. I think that there are a lot of interesting things they could have done. I think they could have turned the heat up on the booking, and they really didn't. It's still very traditional. It's just you have a babyface instead of a heel in there, but you had Vern as champion for years anyway.
Yeah, no, in the 70s, there wouldn't be a lot of title changes.
He put the belt on Martel as a desperation move, so Martel wouldn't leave. So in that regard, yeah, it changed things.
Yeah, going further, did the Nasty Boys versus Rock and Roll Express match make the set?
Yeah, it did, and I really like that match because it's not what I would call a good match, but it's sure as heck a fun match. The Nasties are so out of control. They're so wild. They're so, I'm not going to say clumsy, but, you know, they definitely don't have the polish that they would even have a couple of years later. They're just these wild, chaotic elements, and the Rock and Rolls are obviously so good at what they do, but you almost think that, you know, Sags is going to take one of their heads off, and it makes for a fun match.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, the Rock and Rolls are the ones that hurt SAGs.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, that's probably one of those cases where wrestling is just an illusion, you know? Where you think one thing's going on and something else entirely is going on.
Which it could have been, though, also because SAGs might have been clumsy enough, you know, that he only leaned into a drop kick when he shouldn't have.
But, I mean, you never know what the Rock and Rolls were on at that point.
Yeah, the thing is, I love the Nasty Boys. I remember a couple of years ago when they were in TNA, and people were really shitting on them for being in TNA. But I'll tell you something. I saw Brian Knobbs at close to 400 pounds still going at full speed.
I think a lot of that was just the parody. I mean, that was almost a parody of Hogan bringing these guys in for WCW, you know? I mean, that was comical on some levels in 94, and then you'd have it happen in 2000 and whatever.
Yeah, which is too bad.
Because
you know, a couple of years before, or years ago, like in 1999, a Nasty Boys Dudley Boys feud would have been really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Knobbs is the one that got hurt. No, Sags got hurt. Right?
Yeah, that's always the one that's good that gets hurt.
Yeah. I think that they had some good stuff in 92 with Money Inc. You know, I think that there are definitely good Nasty Boys matches out there if you want to go find them. People sell them way too short.
Do you remember the match from 93 when the Nasty Boys took on the Head Shrinkers in Tupelo Stand Brawl, and they're in the middle of it, they're fighting at the food stand, then they go to a commercial for Somalia Relief.
Yeah. That match, that's pretty bad. It's not the worst, but that's pretty bad. I was reading on, I think it was Bleacher Report, you know, David Bickenstein, he had this one article about how right after Eddie died, they were doing an article about Eddie and about McFoley complaining about how they were using his death. And on the same page, they had one of those Tim White death segments on it.
Yeah, do you think that was an accident? Or do you think that was the way they just had a twisted sense of humor?
I think it was probably an accident. I can just see, especially now, the amount of content that goes up on that site, they probably play it fast and loose, and they know no one's looking at them. You know, Vince has probably no idea what's happening on the website.
Yeah, but the Nessies, they're a really underrated team. I don't know if you saw them in All Japan when they took on Hanson, and I'll tell you, man, they did not back down from even Hanson. I mean, they just went in there.
Yeah, you know, I haven't seen that match. I will check it out at some point, though.
That's unfortunately kind of the problem when I find All Japan stuff sometimes, because it'll have kanji, and I found it just by sheer accident. Because I can't find the Brody and Hanson versus Barry Windham and Ron Fuller match again.
Mm-hmm.
Which it wasn't that good, because they ate them up. Hanson and Brody just ate those two up.
Mm-hmm.
And this is back when Windham with Barry was still really skinny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird because the Tulsa
kid. Go on.
It's kind of weird, though, when you see a tall, skinny guy, because somehow they look more overmatched than a short, stocky guy would.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It looks like they have no muscle mass.
Yeah. Now, also, since I got you here and talk about some comics and stuff, so recently I started reading Mutant X. That was the series from 1999 where they put Havoc on an alternate Earth, which was supposed to start out as an X-Factor storyline, but they decided to do a series because Marvel was trying to diversify their line in some ways then, and not necessarily diversify completely, but they just wanted to do a series that would seem different. That was how Spider-Girl got launched around the same time.
Yeah, no, that was, it's a really fun comic. I like the writing, I like the art, at least for the first 12, 13 issues. After that, I kind of feel like it was Mackie. He had a year one storyline down, and almost as probably a pitch. And after that, I think it loses a little bit, and you'll see as you read. But that first year is really tight.
Well, I'll tell you, I got past issue 12, and the next issue is 13, and it does Bloodstorm's Origin. It says it's written by Ben Rabb, and I'm like, oh, shit. And
yeah,
I haven't read it.
The guy I forgot. He's bad.
Yeah, and I can't skip it. That's the thing. My mentality is I don't want to read it, but I don't want to skip to the next issue.
They, I think they did a really good job with playing with some things that weren't you know, played with too much. Like, they brought Matty Pryor into it, which was interesting. I think Havoc's costume's really cool. But I think what it really is just this kind of almost Inferno-like extrapolation of what the Marvel Universe could be. It seems like one big nightmare.
Weird. Yeah, it feels like Inferno was the big divergent point, even if things diverged before that. It feels like, because, you know, mm-hmm. and again, if I hadn't read all the X-Men Essentials, I would probably still enjoy it, because I like alternate worlds. But I don't think I would appreciate it much like the X-Men being in space, because now I know that they actually did end up in Shi'ar space.
I mean, that's one of the big problems with X-Men in general, and it's something that I don't bump into so much because I've read way too many of them. But you have to make a decision. Do you write an X-Men comic or an X-Men tie-in book or whatever and make it very new reader-friendly, or do you play into all the old history? Because if you do one, you can't really get the full breadth of that Claremont feel, because he was always tying into his own stuff. I think even when Claremont came back in the 90s, in the early noughts, he really was creating new characters left and right, and he wasn't tying into his old stuff as much, and it just didn't resonate as much as his first run.
I think it was probably a difficult situation for him because, again, I think the one thing people can agree on about Claremont is they say anything, but he's a pretty good sport.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he plays fair, and I don't think he wanted to go in there and say, hey, you know all this shit that's been written since I left, it doesn't count.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really necessarily how he does things, though. I do think, you know, I do remember there being something with the Morrison run, though I didn't read any of that.
Yeah, with Morrison, you really get, I'm not saying they're bad comics. They're not. They're well-structured. They're well-put-together. The characterization's fine. But he plays very fast and loose. He picks what he wants to use. He throws out what he doesn't want to use. And it doesn't feel right. Later writers like Mike Carey, Kieran Gillen, you know, they're able to pull together what happened and use it as a tool and make the comic stronger. And maybe the ideas aren't as quite revolutionary and brilliant and whatever else, but it tells a better, more organic, more connected story.
Yeah, I would say that because, you know, you've sent me a few X-Men stories over the years, and I mean, I'm still pissed at you for sending me that new Avengers issue.
Well, you have to talk about what's going on from an educated point of view.
But anyway, I read those X-Men issues, and there are some things I don't necessarily like in X-Men. Like, I don't think I'll ever accept the White Queen, Cyclops stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's something on a basic level that kind of repulses me. But I still say, from the way it's written, it feels like an X-Men issue. And mm-hmm. I read some of the Morrison. I actually read a surprising chunk of the Morrison stuff. You know, because, again, I found it in quarter boxes, and I'll just read whatever. Back then, I read whatever I could find. It wouldn't matter if I liked it or not.
Yep.
You know, because I was just looking for stuff to read. But, and the thing is, some of it was good, and I thought that he did. He played up this ideal that Cyclops had been fundamentally changed from when he merged with Apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there was some interesting stuff, but at the same time, it didn't feel like X-Men comics. It felt like, it felt like if Eclipse in the 80s tried to do an X-Men comic.
Mm-hmm.
Without being X-Men. And, you know, and just get this out before I forget it again. Is I feel like what you have to do when you're trying to make a balance between continuity and new reader-friendly is that I think you can do continuity, but what you should do is you should make it so appealing that the new reader wants to go read the old stuff too.
Yeah, no, and a lot of times, especially with X-Men, the old stuff is so good that there's no, I mean, that's a plus.
Yeah, when I was a kid, that was kind of the fun of comics when you got in superhero comics.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to learn what happened in the past because, you know, because there would be so many pieces. Like, I didn't know the Human Torch was a Golden Age character.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were both Johnny Storm for a time, you know. So, and that's what Mutant X, that's what made it fun, because you kind of have that feeling of not knowing what happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of putting a puzzle together.
Yeah, so you open the door and there's this incredible world out there that they've been working on for decades and decades, and you see a little bit of it and you want to see the rest. It's one of those things that I think it's very American art form only. You don't really get this in other things. I mean, like, anime is very standalone in its own way. It's like soap operas, wrestling, and superhero comics. You go in and you get this entire tapestry that you can learn about and that's been building for years and years upon itself.
Yeah, actually, I could bring Dill in for this right now. Dill, yes. You still there?
Yeah.
One of the things I found appealing when I first got into Dragon Ball, or Dragon Ball Z more accurately, and eventually became the whole series, is it kind of had those superhero trappings because it had such a vast continuity and mythos to it that you wanted to learn more about it. You know, or also, and I think the same thing would go for some other series like Yu Yu Hakusho, where it would have a lot of continuity to it, but in general, I don't think manga had that same thing that you would have with American comics or soap operas.
To me, it's a matter of scope, but what do you think, Neil?
Depends on some manga is actually kind of built to be very long-going with long trappings, but there's still a lot of them, especially with certain anime, that still kind of go for the, you know, episodic. You can catch only one episode. You don't have to catch all the others. And supposedly those, I've heard from other sources that the more episodic ones don't seem to work as well in America because, to us, we already have enough of those. And people generally going out to find anime and manga trying to get something that's new.
And I think if you're telling, let's say, a 26-episode series that's telling one big story where one episode leads to the next, in one way or another, you can tell a much more integrated, detailed, interesting story.
Especially if you have certain animes that have to kind of elongate due to having to keep up with the manga.
Yeah, that's something that I think is more of an issue in the last, 10, 15 years?
Actually, that's been going on for a while.
Really?
Well, I think the really long-running series... Because, and mainly, now Hokuto no Ken or Fist of the North Star, Neil, do you remember the filler episodes they did? They did this one horrible filler episode that should have been good.
Yeah.
So these vampires, and the lead vampire looked like Howard Stern. And it should have been good because you're thinking Fist of the North Star beats Tomb of Dracula. That should be a good premise for an episode.
Nothing happens.
Yeah,
have you ever seen JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, Neil?
I have.
That's when you say Fist of the North Star means Tomb of Dracula, that's kind of what I think of.
The problem is it's hard to get the manga because due to the guy that creates it basically takes all these song titles and band names. They have to keep changing those names.
Well, the main villain for the anime is Vanilla Ice, isn't it?
No, he's one of the second commands and one of the franchise.
No, it's Dio. That's what it is. Ronnie James
that's
Dio.
That's only for the first and third of the JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. That's gone up to 8 or 9.
All right.
The point is that for most people, especially for anime that they have, it's mostly focused on the third series that people know about.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, I don't know if Victor can watch it because of they have a Boston Terrier character in the third series, and I don't know if he wants to see what happens.
Well, is it a white-headed Boston Terrier?
No.
Oh, then I don't want it to die.
Supposedly, it was made worse in the anime OVA that they made back in the 90s.
Well, what it is though, it's a very offbeat. Kind of goofy action takeoff anime and manga, which, I don't know, it's enjoyable in small doses.
Well, the guy who makes it actually looks at fashion magazines for his character designs. So basically, you would have the most villainous character that's very dangerous, that's basically wearing very gaudy yellow with hearts.
It's like fighting Lady Gaga.
What is it, a T-Rex?
No.
Just to say, me and Neil have a running joke as Neil. Matt, you've heard what they say about T-Rexes now, about how they think they had feathers.
Yep.
And this just repulses me, so basically I've been going around calling T-Rexes Phyllis Diller. And so they probably wear lipstick and pearls, and I also said that Buddy Cole from Kids in the Hall was probably right about T-Rexes. to go into... Door on anime. One thing, because I know you haven't seen too much Dragon Ball in general. One thing I like what they've done with some of the filler is, and again, it doesn't get credit for this, but when it has the filler arcs, Toriyama would give suggestions to the writers of ways to expand the mythos of the series. He didn't work on it necessarily, but he would jot down ideals. Like, he wrote down the ideals for the Saiyan homeworld for them to do in an anime arc.
Well, this is one thing that I think is an advantage on some level, and also a disadvantage from American comics, at least the big two comics, is that you have multiple creative voices all combining together. So this sounds like, you know, they have him guiding other writers and working with them. But with American comics, over 30, 40 years, you get, you know, dozens
right.
and dozens of writers adding different
and
views.
It's really cool. And in a lot of ways, it's really cool because you end up with something, and some of these things, like, you know, John Byrne said something, you know, because I go to his forum, you know, and he has interesting ideas about writing in general. He said that Marvel had this thing called Marvel, Serendipity?
Serendipity, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he said there would be some things that Stan and Jack didn't really plan, but when you look back on it, it looks like they did, like Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch being Magneto's kids.
Mm-hmm. I think you've
like
seen that in your own writing, actually, Vic. I think that you've seen, you know, pieces that you put down and you didn't realize that they connect until you look back.
Yeah, I really did, and I would see things, I'd be like, oh, well, sometimes your subconscious is a lot smarter than you are.
And it's also that we have been following this sort of fiction for our entire lives, so we're really good at seeing patterns. So I think that we see things that other people might not, and then we connect the dots, even if they might not have connected otherwise.
Let me ask you a question about Marvel of Mutant X. And again, this might get answered mm-hmm. later, and again, I don't really care about spoilers. Even that deal, I've never really cared about them that much unless it's a funny joke in a
mm-hmm.
show that I... But was the Havoc of the Mutant X Earth evil?
He was very much not a nice guy. That gets played out later in a kind of clunky way with Chuck Austin, so I'm sorry. But, he was definitely not a nice guy.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about, you know, because they play off the ideal that he seems so different, and I'm wondering if he seems different because the Havoc of our world is not a bastard.
Yeah. It's interesting with Havoc. If they never know what to do with him, they just try and thrust him away somewhere. You know, they'll send him off to college, or they'll have him possessed by the chair for a while, or they'll send him to another reality. For a while, he was leading the Starjammers. So it's kind of interesting, because right now, he's front and center. He's actually leading this branch of combined Avengers X-Men. And he did a whole speech about how he doesn't like the word mutant, and he's just a person like anyone else. And he's really in the center of the Marvel Universe right now.
Well, it was one of these funny things. Do you remember during Inferno when the X-Factor met the X-Men again, and Iceman and all of them, they're going, hey, Scott's brother. He's like, Scott's brother, I'm Havoc, Alex Summers. I've lived with you for years. Iceman, I stole your girlfriend.
And he doesn't even get to be the Goblin King at that point. Isn't he like the Goblin Prince?
Yeah, something like that, you know. And again, I love Havoc. He's one of my favorite characters because, I don't know, it feels like this could never quite be Cyclops.
Mm-hmm.
But if you work at it, you could be Havoc.
Sorry. I'm just thinking of Havoc dressed like David Bowie from the Labyrinth.
Yeah, He had this kind of torn apart uniform. Rick will have to show you later. It was like his uniform, but it was only little strips of it. It was bad. It was bad.
Some weird '90s thing that they did to his costume, or like for a cover.
Oh! Not really. They kind of... Okay, the thing about Havoc is he has a really good costume, but for years they would kind of go away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And they would kind of, you know, they wouldn't quite go with it. What I like about Havoc is he's one of the few X-Men that has an arch enemy all his own.
Yeah, they don't use him that much with him, but yeah, he's a cool arch enemy too, because it's... Maybe one reason why they don't use him, and you can tell what he is in a second, is that he's so... not grounded in reality. He's almost like the world's best version of King Tut from the Batman TV show.
Yeah. You know, speaking of, because I remember, I think it was the last time the Monolith was seen during the 12th storyline.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Apocalypse is, and I keep meaning to tell Bill this, you bought me that Update 89 handbook because you found it at a used
mm-hmm.
bookstore.
Yep.
And I got my replacement back. And the funny thing is, when you see the Apocalypse entry, it uses the profile shot of Walt Simonson. And on the side pages, it has to use issues from the Rob Liefeld drawn X-Factor. Now, they
mm-hmm.
never do this. They never do this. But in where it says who did the art, they made sure to specify which parts were Liefeld and which ones were Simonson.
Yeah, they never do that.
It was like somebody said, I think Walt doesn't want us to confuse people. not draw this. And the thing you can tell Liefeld did it, he gave Apocalypse a nose.
Well, it's easy to draw a nose. It's tougher to draw feet.
Yeah, well, no, it was weird how Apocalypse had a nose, because, you know, Simonson does it. He doesn't really have one. He's got kind of these nostrils like a pig.
Mm-hmm.
But he gave him a Liefeld, the pages he drew. He has a very pronounced Iron Man nose.
In those early Apocalypse stories, he was not really the same kind of physical threat he'd later be. You know, he was stretching his body in all kinds of weird directions, and it just—I can't imagine the Apocalypse of, you know, Age of Apocalypse doing that.
Well, having Squats and Stretch look to him.
Yeah,
like he's shield cannons.
Yeah, he was like Hordak.
The interesting thing about Apocalypse is that he's kind of one of those. He's almost a character without a parent because Bob Layton created him in issue 4, mm-hmm. and then Bob Layton left the book for some reason. I think he had a falling out or something, but then Louise Simonson came on and she wrote the character and really developed him into what he is now. You know, so I always wonder what Bob Layton had planned, because it's weird, because he had, like, the Alliance of Evil as henchmen, and it's hard to picture the Apocalypse of today using goons like that.
Yeah, no, again, I mean, those early Apocalypse appearances really don't, and that's true with, like, Mr. Sinister, that's true with, I mean, even Wolverine, you know?
Yeah.
They played up Wolverine like this 20s rebel. Well, you read the Gambit series by Fabian Aziza, though, and that uses Mr. Sinister pretty well, I think.
Yeah, definitely. That's actually what I was going to say. You know, I think I might have mentioned this, that Mr. Sinister was written more like he was in the 80s, as someone
mm-hmm.
that's very dangerous, someone you would not want to mess with.
They, you should see at some point, if you can get past the art, what Gillen did with him, because he made him very British. He made him very about the British kind of ideal of evolution and proper society, and that he basically gave him a purpose. He wasn't just doing research for the sake of research on the Summers branch and whatever like that. He wasn't doing research for the sake of Apocalypse. He was doing research so that he could perfect his own genetic code, so that he could kind of create a Darwinian perfection within himself. And it's one of those things that only a British writer could pull off. I think he did a pretty good job of it.
I can see past any art as long as it's not Greg Land.
Yeah, well, that's what it is, so sorry.
Oh, Jesus.
Greg Land is an artist. Could you technically do it that way?
He's a wonderful tracer.
He didn't always draw that way. Greg Land didn't always draw that way.
No, but he found it. I think it works for him better. I think he gets more money this way.
Yeah,
he probably can get things out quicker, too.
Yeah, he used to not be a terrible artist, but I tried to read one issue of X-Men that he did, and I couldn't get past the second page, and I'm new. And, you know, growing up in the 90s, I'm not picky about art.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, can you notice that it's very inconsistent of how he frames everyone in terms of placement and blocking?
I feel like it has to do with what tracings he has and the angles that they're in and how he can fit them into the scene.
Because I've seen, like, you know, someone be posed this way in one frame, and then, like, the next panel, they're posed in a different way, standing in a different position.
All right, completely different. There's no continuity between panels.
Position. What?
There's no continuity between panels.
Yeah, that's basically it.
Yeah, he's basically just talking
in conversation, like, one be posing with her arms up, then the next pose, they're, like, down very quickly. Then the next
mm-hmm.
pose, she's, like, facing the other way.
I feel like he has a collection of images, and he has to try to figure out how to paste them together into a story. And they don't have all the images that he needs.
I've seen a collage where they have the same oath face for the woman, and for someone screaming.
Oh, yeah. The porn face.
Yeah, it's that porn oath face, and he's used it, like, you know, 50, 100 times.
Which is great when he's using it on, you know, 14-year-old characters.
Yeah, I don't understand how he's able to... the thing is, I don't understand that apparently this is commercially viable, that he's actually a name in art. I could look at Rob Liefeld, and I could actually see the appeal of Rob Liefeld.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was telling Fabian Nicieza this when he was on the show, that the art, there's a lot of energy to it, and he also
mm-hmm.
does a lot of things that would seem to be appealing to kids, like, you know, like when Shatterstorm has, like, the sword that's like a double sword.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's tough.
Yeah, I mean,
people
I think he's just a big kid himself. I think that's what Liefeld is. He's just a big kid.
Yeah. Actually, somebody worked with him mentioned one time that he actually does know that he has problems with anatomy, but he said he got to a certain point that he was afraid to try to fix it because he was afraid that it would make him less commercially appealing.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense. I mean, if you look at how his art's grown over the years, I'm not sure you would see much difference.
Yeah, it's he does stuff, and it's weird because I'll see stuff he does. Like, I'll look at some of them, and he'll do some panels that are really good. Now, I think it's Fabian ECX that told me that he had a lot of assistance sometimes because he was doing so much work at one time that that was why some panels would actually look a lot weaker.
Back to Land for a second, and I want to bring up Kieran Gillen again, but I will, because he has a work blog where he talks about, you know, every issue that he does. He'll break down the script a little bit. And he got put on Iron Man with Land after doing X-Men with him, so he knew what he was getting into. And one thing is he learned how to write for him so that everything is written in Tony Stark vision. So every woman looks like they do because that's how Tony Stark sees them. So he sees every woman as having a porn face, basically.
You look pretty good. You and my repulsor are old.
No, he's like, your touch makes.
Neil?
I think we lost.
Okay. You know, I will say this about Iron Man. I'll say the best thing that the Iron Man movies have done, even as irritating as I find Robert Downey at times now, is that it feels like that it finally buried drunk Tony Stark. Drunk Tony Stark to rest.
I think it almost lionized drunk Tony Stark. I mean, it glorifies it in some ways.
You know, because it was an interesting thing. You know, because again, I remember when I found out Joss Whedon was directing Avengers, and I felt like Joss Whedon directing the Robert Downey Tony Stark was a train wreck waiting to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it ended up being better than that. I don't know. It was weird with my comics development because I feel like if I hadn't had that 1 year's absence, that I probably would have just kept reading and been happy.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what a story when someone gets, they disappear for a year and they come back and they wonder what's happened?
Yep.
I was reading in I stopped reading in late 01 and I tried to come back in the middle of 03.
Mm-hmm. And it was a rough time. I mean, that was the height of the decompression at Marvel with the six-issue stories, and the height of making everything real. Like Squadron Supreme, they brought back, but it was Supreme Power. And the whole idea is, what would this be like in the real world? You know, it was making everything grim and gritty. The Avengers were just fighting ninjas and spies all the time. And it was kind of a rough time where they were trying to find their identity again. They were looking in all the wrong places.
Yeah, it was just, because I would try to recall it. I told you about the time, I'll tell you, the first Avengers comic I picked up after a year, this in 04, was the issue when Hawkeye had sex with the Wasp.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea, again, I had been desensitized to this, so when I looked at it, I was horrified.
Well, that sounds, I think that was Chuck Austin, which is even worse.
Oh, yeah, it was Chuck Austin. Like, there was no concern for continuity, like, none. And it basically came down to, and again, I'm not going to make a personal attack because this is exactly the shit he said. You know, basically because his dad beat his mom, that Hank Pym was going to pay for it.
He's a Vince Russo of comics.
Yeah, it's like there's no need for continuity or anything like that. So he had that happen. Then Hawkeye says that he always hated Hank, which if that doesn't match anything in their published history.
No. And that's what they were doing. They were throwing stuff out so they could tell the stories that they wanted to tell.
Yeah, and exactly. And that's how I always feel about writers that bitch about continuity. I always feel like that they hate continuity because they want to make Spider-Man a date rapist.
Yeah, and you can do that, not make Spider-Man a date rapist, but you can ditch continuity if you have a story that's that worthwhile and you do it smartly. And 9 times out of 10, if you're good enough to come up with a story that good, then, you know, you wouldn't be doing this in the first place.
Exactly, and another thing is that you can do a story where people act out of character because people act out of character in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be your story. Why is this person acting like this? But a lot of times it's just like, you know, I don't want to do those lame comics. Then I try to come back when Bendis was going to do Avengers because I didn't know who Bendis was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a mess.
Yeah, those, I mean, it worked, but it worked because he cheated. You know, those early issues worked because he cheated. I think later on they built it into something else. But I do agree with you that adding Wolverine and Spider-Man to the team is kind of like cheating.
It just watered it down, and I told you my theory about how they're kind of playing with the numbers, how it's basically it's like they probably have the same amount of sales, but they've shifted it over to Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if you look at the Avengers sales numbers in the 80s, and I'm not saying this, I'm talking about on a relative scale.
Mm-hmm.
Like how X-Men was number one, and I always said if you take the amount of readers X-Men had over Avengers, and if you mix them up now, they'd probably be the same amount.
And, you know, for years they did that. Now they've done a better job of building the X franchise back up. Nick Lowe is the group editor on X-Men. I think he's done a really good job of the last 6 years of telling good stories with a very diverse number of X books. So I think the sales have gone back up to a reasonable level. And Spider-Man and Wolverine are much less of a part of the Avengers now as they were a few years ago. It's become almost like the extended Morrison Justice League now, where it's just a lot of people, a lot of characters, big bombastic stories.
Honestly, I don't necessarily have a problem with Wolverine in the Avengers if you're doing a story about it, about why he can't be. I think the frustrating thing for me was that he was still appearing in X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that feels like a cheat.
Yeah, and you know, there is a really good story that Jason Aaron did, who I actually like a lot of his work. He did this amazing Ghost Rider run I should try to make you read at some point. But that he did a story where Wolverine and Spider-Man are talking in a bar together, and this is when Wolverine's on 20 teams. And the story is about, you know, Peter asking Wolverine about how he lives his life, you know, how he can manage to do all this stuff, and why, and what. It's actually a really good story because it asks that question of why is Wolverine, you know, on all these teams? Why? How can he live his life like this?
Yeah. I always have this belief that Wolverine's just trying to forget. And that every second he's not fighting or trying or not being killed, he's probably having to think and deal with his past.
Yeah, I think there is something to that. And he's also always trying to make up for what he's done.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't like thinking like this, but I think if I was ever got full power, I think the only thing I would do at Marvel is that I would make it so Origin never happened.
Yeah, Origin's bad. I don't like it. Something should stay a mystery. And the reason why they said they did it is because they wanted to tell the story before the movies got to tell the story for them. But that's almost like blowing up your own building before someone else blows up your building, you know?
Yeah, and it's one of those things. And I mean, and they didn't do the simplest Origin, which Sabretooth is his dad.
Yeah, and they did an Origin which has nothing to do with anything. It's just this completely... It's okay to do, like, an art story that's completely out of nowhere. But, they are going to do an Origins 2, which has a good writer on it, and it's going to be about kind of him re-entering society in World War One, a lot of cut, and how Mr. Sinister fits in. It should be pretty interesting, actually. It's going to be Leighton Day from the Jenkins book. I never liked Jenkins because he has good ideas, but he is the laziest guy in the world when it comes to reading other stories and factoring in continuity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he gets pissy about it if you ask him.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
Spider-Man Goblin story where they're talking the whole story, and it's just ridiculous because it has nothing to do. I mean, it's almost like if someone who had only read about them but hadn't read any of the comics wanted to write a story, it's just this bad.
Yeah, well, I remember I was reading some of those because I was reading the Mackie run, and, you know, and again, I think Mackie's a very underrated writer. I don't think he gets nearly the credit he deserves. And somehow he had to carry the cross for this. What happened with Swamp?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I feel like he's a very underrated Spider-Man writer, and I like a lot of his X stuff.
Yeah,
and
now,
I'm
going to
be reading these.
What else did he work on? Did he do the first Ghost Rider? Did he do the Dan Ketch Ghost Rider, or what did he do?
Yeah, he did. He created Dan Ketch Ghost Rider.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was his thing, you know, like, I think he did, like, first 50 issues of it.